Chapter 11. Battle Without Honour or Humanity. The SA said that Blue Hades have entrusted Ramona with some sort of exotic high-tech transportation device. But silly me. I wasn't expecting a stealth, supersonic vertical takeoff submarine fueled by the eerily whistling ghosts of necromantically murdered dolphins. I take the lift down to the basement with Ramona and Mary, where we find a near-featureless blue-black lozenge squatting on the concrete floor of the car park. It looms out of the shadows, and I see that its top nearly touches the ceiling. There's no obvious way for it to have gotten in here. As we approach, I get an unaccountable conviction that it's bigger on the inside than the outside. Also, that bits of it change shape whenever I look away. But the real problem I have is that I walk through this garage daily on my way to violin practice in the storeroom, and I've never seen this thing in here before. The implications of its subtle presence are as disquieting as the SA's office window vista. Ramona drives her wheelchair up to the side of the darkling hull and touches it. An oval orifice dilates, rim pulling back like a squid siphon.
"Follow me," she says cheerily. "To the fishmobile!"
A short tunnel leads towards a cramped passenger compartment, fitted with not entirely humanoid seats, at the front of the vehicle. There's some sort of glass cockpit affair at the apex of the narrowing compartment, a wraparound glassy curve that pulses with a dim glow. Ramona drives straight into it and parks her chair in the niche. Four clusters of short tentacles sprout from the floor and twine around her wheels.
"Make yourselves at home and strap in," she says over her shoulder. "We're just waiting for Jim now."
"The window."
Mary sounds as tense as I feel.
"Relax. It isn't glass. It's a projection of what the hull sensors can see, downsampled and filtered to block out blind fire or basilisk attacks. It won't burn you if your sunblock is compromised."
I look around nervously. The seats look as if they came out of a stealth fighter cockpit design exercise by H.R. Geiger. Clearly they share an aesthetic with their office furniture suppliers. I secure my violin in a storage bin against the wall beside my own chair, then sit down and try to work out the intricate five-point restraint system. Mary slides into the seat beside me, clips herself in, then takes a mask out of her handbag and pulls it on.
"Like it?"
she asks. Behind us, Officer Friendly climbs into his chair, fully suited up. It creaks under his armoured weight. The hatch contracts, and my ears pop very slightly. I'm watching Ramona over the back of her chair. She's stroking and squeezing some disquietingly biomorphic controls. I hesitate to call them knobs or a joystick. The boy's own Freudian symbolism, with which aviation technology is freighted, is bad enough as it is. But the way they change shape and pulse as she fondles them is truly disturbing. A hatch in the ceiling above her opens and a helmet drops down, dangling from a fat umbilical tentacle. I'll swear it has suckers. She pulls it down over her head.
"What do you think of..." Mary says then.
"Oh!" We begin to move. The motion is fluid and silent at first, utterly unlike any vehicle I've ever been in before, except for a brief hovercraft trip in my childhood, and that was tooth-rattlingly noisy. We glide forward, between the concrete pillars of the car park, then turn smoothly towards the exit ramp. Faint, ghostly whistles and pops accompany every change of direction. The hair on the back of my neck feels abruptly cold, and my ward burns against my skin. This is necromancy, but not the sort that starts with the destruction of human souls. Some other sapient species, a person, but not in human skin, was sacrificed and bound to power the engine behind us. It twists the computational geometry of space-time around this capsule so that it changes position.
Entropy, information, and energy are all interconvertible sides of the same multidimensional coinage. One paid for in blood and agony. I shudder as Ramona drives her eerie vehicle up the exit ramp, pauses to check for cross traffic, then turns into a street leading to Essex Road. From the outside, we look just like a white Mercedes Sprinter van, she tells us. Same bounding box, same physics model, all simulated. In reality, we're sitting inside a quasi-biological construct powered by necromantic information decay in a pocket universe. But try not to let that get to you. I look at Mary, at a loss for mundane conversational gambits with which to defy the eerie twist to her reality. Nice mask, I say after a while. She nods, expressionless. I can't tell if she's pleased. That's probably the idea. Her face is concealed by a white lacquered shell, with mirror glass inserts where the eyes belong, and a pair of tiny silver fangs protruding from the ruby-painted upper lip. She's bonded it to the front of a black silk balaclava, the neck of which is tucked inside the high collar of her blouse. With her black trouser suit and gloves, her skin is completely covered, protecting her from the lethal radiation of the Daystar. And she actually looks, well, I'm not sure how to describe her. Scary is such an inadequate word, don't you think? I thought if we were actually expected to kick ass in person, we ought to look the part. So you can call me, she pauses for dramatic effect, White Mask. You know, that's actually quite a good name, I agree, and pull my smartphone out to make a note of her alias. First law of vampire school, she reminds me. What's your creation story going to be? It's an origin story, and I haven't thought of one yet. The truth is far too banal. What do you think Ramona should... Ramona steers us onto the northbound carriageway of the A1 and hits the gas. Or piles further torments upon the undead souls of the slaughtered porpoises, or whatever it takes to cause us to accelerate. We gather speed. I try to ignore the high-pitched whistling and sonar ticks as Mary thinks about my question. Ramona's a fucking mermaid, Mo. All she has to do is drop her regular glamour and nobody will recognise her. That leaves Jim and you. Don't look round, says Jim. So I look round.
I said not to look,
Officer Friendly says reproachfully. He's changed into a somewhat more compact version of his armour. The Riot Van Friendly version. His face is invisible behind the mirrored visor of his helmet, and the blue light at its pointy apex is dimmed, pulsing like a sleeping laptop. As for the rest, it looks as if someone commissioned Stark Enterprises to design power-assisted battle armour for Judge Dredd. Or maybe it's just the Territorial Support Group's new model riot gear. Right, I say faintly. Don't worry, Mary reassures me. You can just be scary violin lady. True enough, that pigeon's already flown, and taken a crap all over Trafalgar Square in front of the BBC News 24 cameras. I'm worried about her lack of forward intelligence, I start to say, when Ramona interrupts. Going invisible in 3, 2, 1, now, she announces, and going vertical now. The undead cetacean ghosts scream in existential agony as our vehicle tips back and shudders very slightly. Then a couple of virtual MEs of acceleration land heavily on my lap. I hope she knows what she's doing and cleared restricted airspace before she pulled that stunt. It would be worse than embarrassing to trigger an air prox investigation. London is slap bang in the middle of some of the densest air traffic in the world, and the Civil Aviation Authority is a sister agency of ours. The shuddering diminishes slightly. The roar of wind just beyond the edge of the hull rises, and the sky outside the knot windows slowly darkens as the metropolis drops away beneath us. Above flight level 600, we're out of controlled airspace, our pilot explains. There's nothing to butt heads with except drones and the odd RAF Typhoon, and we can outrun them all. Please tell me you're not going to go supersonic. Too late. She sounds smug. Shit. The paperwork's all yours then. The moaning and clicking from the ghost engine behind us is threatening to give me a headache. I can feel Lecter stirring in his case, irritated and disturbed. Last time the RAF scrambled to intercept an airliner, they broke windows across three counties. Relax. We're way too high for that. All they're here is distant summer thunder. Beginning descent and deceleration in 6 minutes. 6 minutes? But Manchester is nearly 300 kilometres north of London. I glance around the interior of the shiny trade bauble that Blue Hades have loaned us, along with a chauffeur to put it through its paces. Then I think back to the diplomatic reception on the oil platform in the North Sea. Right. I'm just a woman from a tribe of Neolithic dugout canoe builders being given her first ride in an outboard motorboat. Maybe there is a message here. Perhaps Blue Hades simply thought we were getting slightly too cocky and needed a low-key reminder of who owns 75% of our planet's surface area.
I'm not getting a sat phone signal.
Officer Friendly speaks through a voice filter. It lends him a robotic, slightly menacing tone.
Can't punch radio waves through the plasma sheath while we're hypersonic. Don't worry, we'll be down at street level again in just a few minutes.
Ramona sounds distracted. What are we walking into? I ask, trying to keep a lid on my anxiety. We're cut off from base. Our analysts don't have full access to the police national computer network anyway. And we didn't have time for a full briefing after what happened at the library. I'm feeling very twitchy. Jim, what do you know?
The deputy chief said it was kicking off in Oldham. It started with a previously scheduled EDL demonstration and an anti-fascist action counter demo. Nothing unusual, but it brewed up larger than expected, then turned ugly. Then the major incident kicked off. Confirmed superpower involvement. Officers injured. Extensive property damage. Civilian demonstrators injured. An ambulance crew hurt and their vehicle destroyed.
Shit, says Mary.
My thought exactly. Jim continues.
We need more intel. We can't go in blind in a situation like this. We could easily make things much worse. So the first thing to do is to go find the incident commander and get briefed.
Yes, absolutely. I agree. Ramona, we need to set down somewhere so we can get a sit rep. How long?
I'm hauling arse to get us there as fast as I can. She says, just slightly reproachfully. I can land us within a mile of Oldham Centre. There's a good-looking football ground not far from there, and it's a weekday, so the car park shouldn't be full.
Oh, God. I can just see the headlines. Superhero team touches down between goalposts at Old Trafford. Pitch ruined. I take a white-knuckled grip on my armrests as the doleful wailing of doomed dolphins lowers in pitch. And the straps tighten around my torso. We're going in. Untrained, undrilled, unpracticed, unbriefed. And we're not even the right team. We don't have a catchy name, an origin story, or matching underwear. The probability of this turning into an utter, irredeemable clusterfuck approaches unity. I close my eyes and hope the others don't pick up on my nerves. Because I have a terrible premonition that things are going to get a lot worse before there's any chance whatsoever of them getting better. 8 minutes after departure, we land in the car park of the Wearnoth Mosque, just across Manchester Street from Wearnoth Park in Oldham. The sky is slate grey, a cold drizzle is falling, and a pall of smoke rises above the houses and shops to our north. The car park is littered with half bricks and broken bottles. The only reason the mosque's windows aren't smashed is the bars protecting them. A convoy of police vans are parked nose to tail on the main road.
sliding doors open, and mesh screens deployed across their windshields. The distant roar of an angry crowd drifts across from further up the road, in the direction of the city centre. They're chanting loud slogans, something ugly about Muslims. Other voices rise against them in counterpoint with another chant. Two tribes, trying to drown each other out. Or, given the weather, trying to provoke the other side into opening their mouths wide enough to drown in the rain. A mobile police command centre is parked in front of the mosque, obviously positioned to send a message to any hotheads who get too carried away. And also because the mosque is surrounded by high spiked railings and brick walls. Neighbourhood relations here clearly leave something to be desired. When we arrive, the incident commander, a regular superintendent, is calmly speaking into a Tetra headset, while the staff of the command centre direct mobile units around the high-detail maps on their computer screens. There are other screens displaying the camera feed from the helicopter overhead and a handful of camera vans.
"Where is he now?" asks the super.
"Good.
Try to keep him there. I'll have more resources for you shortly."
She ends the call and stares at us.
"What took you so long?"
I clear my throat. "We were in London when we got the call, then in communications blackout during travel."
"Understood. So let me make this clear up front. I'm running this show. I point you and pull the trigger, and you do what I say. As long as you bear that in mind, we'll get along fine. Who are you?"
"I'm Dr. O'Brien, Transhuman Policy Coordination Director." I pull out my warrant card. "This is my team, Officer Friendly, Ramona Random, and the White Mask. Your turf, your show, understood." "But who are you, ma'am?"
"Superintendent Alice Christie, Greater Manchester Police."
She unfreezes.
"Okay. I've heard a lot about you," she tells Officer Friendly. "This should be right up your street."
I put myself forward. I don't want her bypassing me and going straight to Jim. "What's the situation on the ground?"
"Bad."
She has a cop's roving eyes. From her expression, as she gives us a second once-over, she isn't sure she likes what she's seeing.
"The EDL filed a 3175 2 weeks ago. About 250 supporters were due to assemble on Railway Road at 1 p.m. and march down Manchester Road to Copster Hill, right past this mosque, then disperse. They started in the pub and got a bit rowdy as usual, but that's when AFA sprang an illegal lightning counter demo on us. They organised a flash mob, converged on St. Thomas Church, then headed on course to collide with the EDL right here. The anti-fascists got a turnout of about 100 to 150 bodies, and the locals aren't exactly EDL supporters either."
The English Defence League, self-named, are the knuckle-dragging wing of the British neo-Nazi racist fringe. They claim to want to defend England for the English, defined as anyone who's white, working class. They hate immigrants, the police, and anyone who can count without using their fingers. They like football, cheap beer and curry, and trouble. Don't ask me how they square the curry-slash-immigrant circle. Anytime they march in a dirt-poor neighbourhood that's 25% Muslim, like Oldham, you can guarantee they generate a robust response from the locals and produce a huge headache for the police. Officer Friendly rotates his helmet in my direction, then back to Christie. The nearest thing to a glance his robo-suit will let him make.
"Who escalated first?" he asks.
"At first we had the EDL nicely boxed, but when AFA jumped us, we had to call in all our support units. We were getting ready to kettle the illegals when the fash got wind there was a counter demo, and about a dozen of them broke through our line and headed for Wellington Road. Which is a bit of a slog, frankly. You might have noticed the landscape hereabouts is a bit steep, and the officers on the ground didn't manage to head them off in time. So then we had the charming prospect of a dozen idiots with baseball bats charging at a much larger group who were looking for trouble.
Then somebody set fire to one of our vans, and everything went to hell. She shakes her head. Lucky there was nobody in it at the time. We thought at first it was terrorism-related, but no. Intel from ground level says it looks like the Fash have a super skinhead, who was flying, throwing lightning bolts, and shouting, "Fuck off back to Pakistan, or I'll stick a pig up your ass," at the AFA. Charming. Her irony is leaden. I'd have him under a Section 4 if I had the firepower to make it stick. Anyway, that's when I asked the chief to send up the bat signal for you people. But it gets worse. Right in the middle of me trying to contain two different demos, the sky turned funny. Forward intel says there's a djinn upstairs fucking with the weather. So there's a Nazi Übermensch on a beer-fueled rampage, some kind of supernatural maniac throwing lightning bolts upstairs, and there's not a damned thing I can do except keep the mundane demonstrators kettled up where they can't cause any collateral damage. She doesn't sound happy. Well, I see. Officer Friendly is sworn in with the London Met on secondment to ACPO. He's also an authorising officer for firearms and other weapons. I myself, and my other colleagues, are not police officers. My unit isn't fully operational yet. However, we're affiliated with the security service and can provide backup for Officer Friendly. If you point us at this, Übermensch and his pal and pull the trigger, we can try to take him down. So I suggest we... I gesture to include myself, Ramona and Mary. Handle communications and coordination while the Tin Man here does the heavy lifting. Right. That sounds like a reasonable plan. As long as you stick to a supporting role. She waves over a PC who's waiting by the screens at the back. You, take these specials to Inspector Cho. He can direct them at the scene. There is nothing heroic or noble about the wake of a riot. Broken glass and dog shit on the pavements. The choking smells of burning plastic and petrol. Damp-streaked red brick terrace houses with their windows smashed. The ferocious barking of chained pit bulls defending their yards mingles with the off-key team chants of hatred, keeping time with the stamping of feet from up the steep, potholed street. The sky is as grey as the roads and the grass, and the rain just keeps on coming. The EDL are kettled two streets over, says Inspector Cho, pointing. He is in full riot gear, which tells me at once that I'm underdressed for this dance.
Understood, blats Officer Friendly. The superpowered one?
He was over there. He gestures at the end of Monmouth Street, where two fire engines are hesitantly probing for a way past an overturned van towards an ominous column of rising smoke. Throwing cars at the other one. He winces. That stopped about a minute before you turned up. A white transit van, bonnet flopping open, rises above the sway-backed roofline of a row of back-to-back terraces and crashes into the road just in front of the fire engines. I flinch at the bang. So does Inspector Cho, as do the other cops who form a loose line across the other side of the street.
Jesus.
Incoming, Ramona says tonelessly. An iridescent bubble appears around her motorized wheelchair. I dry swallow, then open my violin case. I don't know what exactly I can do with Lecter if they're throwing two-ton vans at each other, but it feels better to have my sly monster in hand. I turn him upside down to shield the strings from the rain, wishing I'd brought an umbrella.
Let me handle this,
says Officer Friendly. He takes two steps forward, gathers himself and jumps. Unlike you or me, he soars above the houses on the other side of the main road, where he hovers briefly. Until a violet-white spark of lightning flashes down from the clouds, and he plummets.
Fuck!
Says the white mask. She blurs forward. One of the riot cops turns towards her and she vaults over him using his shoulders as a platform. He goes sprawling as she sprints into a side alley between two terraced houses. I am in the process of raising my violin when there's a tooth-grating crashing sound.
Officer Friendly wobbles into the air on the far side of the terrace, and I gasp with relief. But then there's a shout.
Come here if you think you're hard enough.
I catch Ramona's eye. Mary needs backup. She nods and begins to roll forward. I trot alongside her wheelchair. The cops take one look at us and make way. We head for the same backyard that the white mask vanished into, the one Officer Friendly came down in. The streets are narrow and cling to the steeply sloping sides of the valleys where they were built to provide cheap housing for mid-19th century mill workers. The houses are built back to back and shoulder to shoulder, so that they each have only one exterior wall. Each row is pierced at intervals by dank tunnels that lead into the yards at the rear, giving access to the back of the row. They're cramped and cold and prone to rising damp, and the only reason they still exist is that the people who live in them don't have the money to live anywhere better. This part of the world has been living in an economic downturn since the early 1980s, like a never-ending bad dream. The alley Mary ducked into is slimy with lichen, cobblestoned, and piled half-high with domestic trash along one wall. It stinks of decaying cabbage, overlaid by a tang of more exotic spices, cumin and tamarind and mete. Something feels wrong to me, but I don't have time to pay attention to that right now. The yard at the end is partitioned by rotting wooden fences to either side, terminated by a brick wall at the back. Where, I begin to say. Then Ramona waves for silence. It's a wheezing gasp from the far side of one fence. It sounds human and repetitive. Someone is panting for breath. The gasping trails off into a hoarse whine as if they're in so much pain they can't scream anymore. A shadow overhead. It's Officer Friendly. He lands beyond the wall with a rattling crash. Another shadow passes over us, and I look up into a swirling cloud with the face of a man snarling hatred at something that crawls across the ground below. Bastard motherfucker! Someone beyond the wall screams. My hair is trying to stand on end, my scalp prickling with a gathering premonition of thunder. I raise my violin and witness the scene around me through Lecter's senses. Hollow stone skulls lie in rows up and down the spine of a drowning world that teems with unclean, verminous human life, crackling and hissing with imbecile thoughts, easily stilled by my will. Overhead, a slowly whirling vortex of power gathers its force to strike at a mantis-like presence of pure energy. Wearing the body of a wiry man with tattooed skin and swastikas on his knuckles, who stands and shrieks defiance at the sky. Fucking immigrant Packy, fuck off back to Raghead Land, or I'll fucking stab you in the fucking balls! I snap back into my own head as the cloud above us begins to swirl faster. That's not good. I move my fingers into position and set bow to string, pulling in a note, and then changing key and shifting, looking for the right harmonic to drain the life energy out of the thing in the sky.
You want me to do what?
Lecter is surprised. There's a loud crunch as Ramona rams her wheelchair into a rotting gate. She pulls back, rams again, and the gate collapses. She rides over it like a tank fording a river. Then she screams. A pale green glow suffuses everything, the gathering energy of a lightning strike. We shouldn't even be here, I think distantly, as I raise my weapon and take aim. We're management, not heroes. There is a pink-blue flash so intense that it blinds me, followed instantaneously by an explosion. I stagger and my feet go out from under me on the wet cobblestones and I fall over. But whatever the lightning bolt struck, it wasn't me.
I'm deafened and dazzled. But I'm still alive. I hear distant screams. Then a repetitive thudding. It reminds me of distant rocketry over the Baka Valley. I try to stand, shivering with suppressed panic. If you can hear them, they're not coming your way, I remember.
Are you all right?
It's Officer Friendly. He lifts me to my feet and I lean against him for a moment. Well, that didn't work too well, I manage.
Are you all right?
He repeats, then peers at me.
I'm going after Ramona. Wait here.
I nod dizzily and manage to step back while he turns and darts through the broken gate where Ramona vanished. The sobbing, hoarse-voiced moaning from inside the house is back, and it sets my teeth on edge. Fuck this, I think, and strike up a lullaby for monsters. Going after the djinn didn't work too well, but he's not my only target today. The strings begin to glow as I hit the simple melody. I play faster, fingertips sore. I know how to hit the right frequency to captivate minds, soothe them into sleep. All my people have wards, but I'm betting the random super strong idiot shouting imprecations at the sky doesn't. I don't need to overdrive this. I just need to make him fall asleep, as if he's had one tinny of special brew too many. As for the angry face in the sky, I have a theory about that. I hear a hammering crash from the yard where Ramona, Officer Friendly, and Mary have gone to make their arrest. The shouting and sobbing and screaming, none of it theirs, slowly fades to the tune of Rockabye Baby. Suddenly, I'm nose to nose with Mary's expressionless white mask.
You can stop that now, she says tensely. Jim's got his man. It's a real mess in there. We have injured civilians.
I look up at the whirling clouds above. Is it my imagination or do they seem to be trying to form a funnel? It's not over. Let's get back up. I trot after Mary as she zips back in the direction of the police line. I catch up with her as she delivers the news to Joe.
Two civilian casualties need medical attention urgently. Officer Friendly is also requesting a shielded heavy custody vehicle for the super he's restraining.
I clear my throat.
No time, mate. White mask. We have to get back to the mosque right now.
Cho turns on me.
Why? What so?
I point a finger straight up. One down. One to go.
Shit.
Mary says succinctly.
You're sure...
Look in the classrooms behind the prayer hall.
Lecter whispers in the back of my head. He sounds dryly amused. His ghostly laughter echoes in my head like the papery rustling of mummified hands raised in applause.
Come on!
The clouds are still turning grey-purple and ominously engorged.
We've got to move right now!
The broken sky tries to murder me as I cross the road. I keep Lecter raised, fingering a C-sharp like an arrow held against a taut bowstring. When the brilliant pink flash hammers down at me and splashes off across the cobblestones all around, I feel a distant tingling, but nothing more. Lecter can eat more types of energy than souls. The sky thunders its rage and disapproval, mouthing imprecations at the tiny figures below. Superintendent Christie barrels out of the command centre, followed by a pair of bobbies.
Why are you back again?
She demands. I point at the front door of the mosque.
You need to search the classrooms in back. You're looking for a man with a book, ritual trappings and a sacrifice.
A black goat would be standard if they can rustle one up at this kind of notice. Otherwise a chicken. I'm pretty sure it's considered haram to do that ritual at all, let alone in the grounds of a mosque, but then...
What for? We can't just storm a mosque.
There's your reasonable grounds for suspicion, I say. I point up at the circling clouds, which briefly form the visage of a scowling man's face. You're looking at a weather control invocation. Officer Friendly is busy pacifying your Ubermensch and the rest of us don't have your legal authority. Christy follows my finger, then nods jerkily. You'd better be right. The implicit "or else" hangs in the air as she turns to her two escorts. Follow me! Then she storms up the steps to the front door of the mosque and hammers on it. Police! The door opens. I take the steps two at a time behind her. The caretaker, or possibly Imam, falls back.
You can't come in here,
he says half-heartedly.
Yes, I can. I've been informed that a crime may be in progress on these premises.
Christy glances over her shoulder at me. I don't need to be a telepath to know what she's thinking. If you're wrong about this, it's your ass.
Which way are your classrooms?
Round the corridor, but miss, you can't...
He falls back in front of her, protesting all the way. She's polite but firm, very firm, taking no shit.
How many classrooms do you have here? Are there fire exits? Which way are they? Where... Okay. You have 2 seconds to open this door, or I'm going to do it myself. Don't make me wait.
Our unwilling guide opens the door and walks in. He does a double take.
Hey, Anwar, what are you doing?
There is a crimson flash of light and a deafening bang from across the room. Then it's raining indoors and Lecter's strings flare the light electric. I take 2 steps forward, shoes slipping on the suddenly wet floor as I pass a cop in riot gear who is standing in place, smearing the blood around on his visor in a desperate attempt to see what's happening. I pluck notes from my instrument, notes that absorb the thunder, and fall flat and oppressive on my ears like atonal anti-music. Lecter nimbly drives my fingertips as I raise the blood-spattered bow and draw it across electric blue strings that leave purple after-images in my vision. After-images like warped and melted prison bars that wrap around the silhouette of the man who stands chanting in the centre of the summoning grid, holding a knife and the bleeding body of a black cockerel.
Fun,
sings my instrument, as the perp brings the knife to bear, pointing it at us and chanting the lightning down. There are green worms spinning in his eyes, because of course you don't get to run this kind of summoning without shielding and still keep your soul intact. This is classic suicide cultist territory, and Anwar isn't alone in his head anymore. There's another pink-blue flicker, bang, and I'm dazzled and deafened, nearly thrown off my feet as Lecter absorbs a direct lightning strike at point-blank range.
Police! Drop it!
Yells the other officer, the one who hasn't lost his lunch all over what's left of the caretaker. He's drawn his Glock, and he's given warning, and he's about to double-tap the summoner, which would be fine by me if he was dealing with a regular armed lunatic. Unfortunately, he isn't. The revenant in the grid is still chanting, and now he turns his knife in a circle, waving it in all the cardinal directions. My skin tries to crawl off my body with the intensity of the thaum field he's gathering around him.
May I?
Pleads Lecter. Yes, I say. And he takes full control of my hands and... hiatus. The next thing I am aware of is Alice Christie speaking rapidly into her tetramic.
We're in the back of the mosque. Entry with probable cause. 2 confirmed dead. 1 officer down needs urgent medical support. Dead include prime suspect and earlier lightning-induced fatalities.
Someone takes my elbow.
Ew, tasty. Come on, Mo, let's get you out of here.
They tug insistently, and I turn, mind-fogged and numb.
Damn, I really need a drink. What a waste. Come on, walk, damn it.
Mary shoves me towards the door.
That looks nasty. I hope you've got a change of clothes back at the office. I guess now we know why real superheroes wear artificial fibres.
I slip and slither across the caretaker's intestines, which have somehow untangled into a complicated grey-pink maze between the upper and lower halves of his torso. Mary steers me around the tactical Ted, who, having lost it, is now shivering by the door. The smell of blood and feces is a sullen reek in my nostrils, nauseating and fierce. "Let's go home," I mumble. It's funny. Now I'm no longer in play. Trying to hold on to my own stomach contents is turning out to be a real chore. I hate wet work. It triggers hideous flashbacks, and I can't get the mental taste of Lecter's gloating satisfaction out of my mouth. Not letting him off the leash whenever he feels like it is about 80% of my job. It's small consolation that the feeder animating Anwar's body was gearing up to zap us repeatedly until crispy, or that the man himself had died sometime before we got here. Why does this stuff always have to happen to me? We stumble out into the daylight, blinking and cringing in Mary's case. The clouds are thinning rapidly. The rain has stopped, and I can see a blue patch of sailor's pants beyond the rooftops across the road. Ramona's not-so-yellow submarine is parked beside the command truck, still disguised as a white Mercedes van. I stumble straight towards it, when there's a thunder of rotors directly overhead, and I look straight up into a big telephoto lens poking through the open door of a helicopter. "Don't say anything compromising," Mary reminds me. "We're on candid camera." She pushes me back towards the mosque doorway, then pauses, body language telegraphing distaste. "And you're really going to have to bin that suit before the press conference, dear. Those bloodstains will never come out." "Wonderful," I manage. Trying to match her mordant humour seems to help with the chore of holding things together. "This day just keeps on getting better." "Yes, it does," says Superintendent Christie, her grim reaper voice just behind my right ear. "Because you do not get to bugger off back to London and leave me carrying the can. Once I get that bloody chopper out of the picture, you and I," she pokes me in the small of my back, "are going to have a little chat about what happened in there. Because my boss is going to ask me for an explanation, and it had better be one which won't set this whole city on fire by nightfall. Is that clear?" We end up in a briefing room in a police station on Barn Street. At least it's not a cell. That's a hopeful sign. We're not, it seems, expected to shoulder the blame for Ubermensch going off his trolley, throwing six assorted vehicles around, upending an ambulance, severely injuring half a dozen anti-fascist action members, and nailing a middle-aged taxi driver to the back wall of his home for the crimes of having been born in Peshawar and dyeing his beard with henna. In fact, Officer Friendly is quite popular with the force hereabouts, having saved any number of his non-superpowered colleagues the trouble of having to tackle the aforementioned juiced-up thug themselves. However, we're getting rather less love for how we dealt with Anwar Kadir, a regular at the mosque, an all-around good egg, until he pulled out the extremely dodgy textbook, inscribed a summoning grid in the number 2 classroom, sacrificed a rooster, and got himself taken over by a class 4 manifestation, commonly known by the locals hereabouts as a djinn. The death of Mohammed Nazir, the unfortunate mosque committee member who let us in, is not going to be easily brushed under the carpet. Neither is that of Mr. Kadir, although the fact that he was throwing lightning bolts around at the time and threatening a superintendent weighs in our favour. But the steaming turd in the soup tureen is the fact that we went inside a mosque in hot pursuit and killed him. This is not good. In fact, it is extraordinarily bad. It would be bad enough if we'd done it in a church or a synagogue, but doing it in a predominantly Muslim neighbourhood in the middle of a race riot. Paradoxically, what saves the day? turns out to be the TV news cameras, showing me stumbling out into the daylight with my arm over White Mask's shoulders, both of us absolutely covered in gore. Mary was right. My suit's utterly ruined. But it takes very little effort to imply that I've been injured in the course of taking down a super-powered monster. Superintendent Christie simply arranges for an ambulance to back up to the front door and for me to be taken away on a stretcher. Mr. Nazir was not the only member of the Moss Committee to be sheltering on the premises. When the super invited them to examine Kadir's little pentacle, there were many sharp intakes of breath. Then the imam picked up the book Mr. Kadir was working with, disturbing the crime scene, but we'll let that pass, and started swearing loudly in Pashtun. It was not a copy of the Quran. It was not a holy book at all. In fact, it was very, very unholy indeed, positively unclean, and he wanted it removed from his mosque as fast as possible. We, I am using the corporate we here. I personally wasn't involved at this point in time. We're happy to make it go away. The laundry is always happy to expand its archives. But this leaves us dealing with the unpalatable task of explaining our role in a multiple fatality police incident involving two separate riots and a superhero dust-up. If I was an authorised firearms officer and I'd just shot someone, hell, if I'd so much as drawn my gun and pointed it, never mind discharging it, I'd be facing a lengthy period of suspension on pay pending an IPCC inquiry to determine if in fact I had behaved lawfully, with possible prosecution at the end of the process if I hadn't. I'm not a police officer, and I didn't use a firearm, and I'm actually supposed to be running a new type of quick reaction force with backing from the Home Office, and the procedures were supposed to follow start out murky, then drive off a legal cliff. Which makes it a very good thing indeed, that the only witnesses were Mary, me, Superintendent Alice Christie, Constable Ed Carter, hospitalised for shock, under heavy sedation, may never work again, and Sergeant Barry Sampson, who had actually drawn on Mr. Kadir and was about to pull the trigger when I beat him to it and maybe saved his life. And which also explains why at 10 o'clock at night, I'm sitting in a briefing room, wearing a set of exercise sweats borrowed from the GMP ladies' basketball team and drinking a bottle of Coke Zero while Alice, who has spent the last 4 hours on damage control, explains what's going to happen in words of one syllable. Mary, who escaped the worst of the mess when Mr. Nazir exploded because she was standing behind me, is also present. She's removed her mask and is looking surprisingly subdued. I am not going to charge you with manslaughter, Dr. O'Brien, because it is patently obvious that you are acting in self-defense and indeed in defense of myself and my officers. Personally, I would like to thank you for what you did back there. Nevertheless, I and my force commander would be extremely pleased if your team could refrain from visiting us again in an active frontline role until all your people are officially on the books as sworn-in constables. If the Met would see fit to discover that they've misplaced the paperwork and you simply forgot to tell me that your attestation was held the day before yesterday, that would be amazingly helpful. Oh, and if you could remind your friend from ACPO that he designated you as an authorised firearms officer as well. You will need to talk to the IPCC about establishing due procedures for investigating fatalities resulting from the actions of officers on your, force, and for controlling the use of potentially lethal weapons. I assume you have no objection to my division filing the preliminary paperwork to refer Mr. Kadir's death to the IPCC, and will supply your own sworn testimony in due course. I understand. I see woodenly. There's no credit to be gained by pointing out that in my parent organisation, we regularly use lethal force with minimal oversight. Quite the contrary. I'm not in Kansas anymore, and the security service is supposed to leave this kind of headbanging to SCO-19 and, in extremis, the army. Alice rolls her eyes,
You would not believe the shitstorm that's going to land on my head tomorrow, and on yours the day after. IPCC fatal incident investigations rattle on for years. They don't terminate until the weight of paperwork exceeds the fully loaded coffin and the gravestone on top. Sometimes they result in a manslaughter prosecution. I'm pretty sure this one won't, but your delayed or misfiled paperwork is absolutely not going to make things better. You can expect a dressing down from professional standards at the very least. And I'm serious about not coming back here until you've got your ducks in a row. Believe me, I'd like nothing more than to do that, I tell her. Yes, a 3 to 6 months paid vacation would be just fine right now. I instinctively nudge my violin case with one foot. I spent a couple of hours cleaning it, but there are still patches of dried blood that will take specialist attention. I'm not sure we've got time, though. My unit didn't even exist until last Tuesday. You'd better make time. If this was your organization's first outing, you might be able to roll over it, or not. But it all depends on whether the Home Secretary is feeling merciful and how the press spins things in tomorrow's broadsheets. At least Officer Friendly is on the books, and tackling that tanked-up chav is going to earn credit in the right places. We'd better head back for London, I say tiredly. Mary sniffs.
Ramona can drive. Officer Friendly took off a couple of hours ago under his own power.
You go. Alice shakes her head. I'll walk you to the car park. Oh, and we haven't had this conversation. Understand?
Absolutely.
I see.
Yes, agrees Mary.
Good. Because if we had accidentally discussed ways of working around an independent police complaints commission investigation, that would be very bad indeed. For all of us. And that's how our superhero team's first clash with the forces of evil comes to an end. It's after 11 at night by the time Ramona, having driven out of town in her white van camouflage, takes us up into the starry vastness of the stratosphere, while the abyssal ghosts hoot and trill in existential pain behind us. We blaze a cometary course southeast before descending somewhere north of the M25 to drive back into town along the A1 in dugout canoe mode. Consequently, we don't slither and slide into the car park until shortly after midnight. As soon as the hatch dilates, my smartphone beeps repeatedly, announcing a slew of messages. Wait, I say. The very first one I glance at is an SMS from Dr. Armstrong. See me in your office as soon as you arrive. Bring everyone who is travelling with you. Damn.
What? Says Mary.
We're meeting the auditors upstairs right now.
Shit.
It occurs to me that Mary is getting just a tad repetitive. I resolve to find a way to tackle her about her language, but not right now.
Do they want me too?
Ramona sounds mildly anxious. It occurs to me to wonder if she's made the auditor's acquaintance yet. Yes, they want all of us. Follow me, I say, and I stumble tiredly towards the lift. I'm still wearing the borrowed sweats, violin in one hand, and bagged up remains of my second-best work suit in the other. I don't so much feel like I've been dragged backwards through a hedge as I feel like I've been stomped flat, chewed up, and spat out by the Cape Buffalo that lives on the other side. The lift door opens onto the twilit lobby. There is a trail of light leaking along the corridor from the boardroom doorway. My mouth tastes of ashes, and I'm exhausted. I really don't feel up to another grilling today, but needs must. I slowly walk towards the inevitable reckoning. I'm about to touch the door handle when someone opens it from the other side.
Ah, Dominique, says the SA.
His smile is polite but strained.
Do come in. And you, Ms. Murphy, Ms. Random.
He looks past us.
Chief Superintendent Gray is elsewhere. Excellent. Do make yourselves comfortable.
Yes, do, echoes the silver-haired elder from the audit committee who confronted me the week before. Please, seal the room, Dr. Armstrong.
They've brought food. My nostrils flare. The odour of pizza drifts from a stack of square boxes in the middle of the table. They've even brought drinks, or at least bottles of mineral water. I'm instantly on edge, scenting a setup.
I expect you've Mr. T,
says the mouse lady from the audit committee. The only one who's not here is the woman named Persephone.
Do sit down, ladies.
Her attempt at emulating domestic hospitality is a washout, I'm afraid. She's even less good at doing motherly than I am. The SA paces the perimeter of the room, sprinkling white powder from a silvery thermos flask. Mary looks at me apprehensively, then takes a seat. Ramona rolls up beside her. I don't understand, I say, glancing at Dr. Armstrong.
He's establishing a field expedient grid, says Silverhair. Total privacy is required. In the meantime, feel free to tuck in, you must be famished. Oh, I nearly forgot.
He picks up a different thermally insulated container decorated with biohazard symbols.
This is for you, Ms. Murphy. I suggest you consume it within the next hour. It will be non-viable by tomorrow.
I shudder and look away, suddenly nauseous. Oh, God, they did it. They went and did it. Fangs need a blood meal at least once every 2 weeks, or their V-parasite runs wild. The trouble is, it has to be blood from another living human being. The commensal parasites that give them their superpowers, by way of the law of contagion, use the blood as a bridge into the brain of their victims, which they chew holes in. Blood is just a communications channel, not the meal itself. And V-syndrome is a horrible, neurodegenerative affliction I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy. Similar to K-syndrome, except at one remove. Hideous and terminal and... Mouse woman notices me staring.
The donor is in a hospice, Dr. O'Brien, in the end stages of malignant melanoma. In this instance, she is already unconscious and will be dead of natural causes within 24 hours. She won't have time to suffer from V-syndrome.
Mary gives me a guilty sidelong look, her shoulders hunched. I look away and swallow. My stomach rumbles and the pizza smells wonderful, but I don't feel right about dining at this table.
Please go ahead and eat.
Mouse woman tells me, a note of iron creeping into her voice.
This meeting is going to take some time.
Damned if I do, damned if I don't. I can still taste the metallic strangeness of Mohammed Nazir's blood on my lips. I spat and rinsed with bottled water, but it doesn't seem to go away. I pull the nearest box towards me and open it. Pineapple and mushroom and ham. Doubly damned I am. I nibble on the edge of a slice, as Dr. Armstrong repeats his circuit of the room, chanting quiet mnemonics in Old Enochian. He sketches a ward on the boardroom door, then connects a crude-looking black box to the salt trail using a ribbon cable, takes a seat at the table, and switches on an LED camping lantern.
Is everybody ready?
He asks. I nod, mouth full. Mary is sucking liquid through an opaque straw. Ramona shakes her head.
Not really,
she says quietly. She's been unusually subdued since we came up here. I wonder if she knows how she's been set up.
Tough.
The SA smiles humorously as he bends down and presses a button on the black box. The office and the faint traffic noises from outside vanish. We sit around a boardroom table floating atop a circle of carpet, surrounded by total blackness, eating pizza and drinking blood. The only illumination is the SA's camping lantern.
We have some questions for you, says Dr. Armstrong. One at a time. Starting with precisely what happened between the time you left the car park below this building
and the time you returned. In your own words, without compulsion. Mo, you first.
He raises his fingers, and the quality of sound in the ward deadens, until the only things I can hear are the auditors and my own voice. Great, they've put the others in a cone of silence. Fever chills run up and down my spine. What about Jim? I ask.
You have no need to know.
Mouse woman's eyes are shadowed. Oh dear. Well then, I lick my lips. Ramona led us to her vehicle and then... It seems to take forever to tell the tale. But the auditors listen patiently. Then they release Mary from the cone of silence and ask her to recount her version of events. I'm allowed to listen in, but not contribute. As their manager, I may have to defend them later if they say anything inadvisable. I cringe when she gets to the sequence where Officer Friendly broke into the taxi driver's backyard and found what Ubermensch had done there. Disgusting doesn't begin to describe it. Stomach churning? Yes. But his sadism was constrained in the end by his lack of imagination. It was vile, but petty. Mary describes the events in the classroom at the mosque and her subsequent discussions with Superintendent Christie. She makes no attempt to dissemble or self-censor, which surprises me. I didn't know she'd encountered Dr. Armstrong and his colleagues in their professional capacity before. But her body language is totally cowed, submissive. Not what one would expect from one of the self-identified lords and ladies who rule humanity from the shadows, setting interest rates and offering credit. Not even what you'd expect from a vampire. Finally, it's Ramona's turn. But at this point, she's pretty much just confirming what Mary and I told the auditors. At the end, the mouse lady nods.
I believe your accounts are consistent, she says. Michael?
Yes, the SE says slowly. Yes, indeed. Dr. O'Brien, he leans forward. Did you at any time see Chief Superintendent Gray? From the time you entered the basement to the time you arrived back here? Wait, what? Of course, I say, confused. He was sitting right behind me in the flying submarine. I'm sorry, but I believe I have not made myself sufficiently clear. You have said that you saw Officer Friendly sitting behind you. Did you at any point see James Gray's face? Well, I sit back and glance at Ramona. She looks bewildered. Well, no, but he had his armor on the whole time. Why would I see his face? Ms. Random, Ms. Murphy, did either of you see Chief Superintendent Gray, or just a suit of armour? Well, Mary pushes her biohazard container aside and licks her lips. They glisten black in the dim glow of the lantern. I don't believe so, she says hesitantly.
It was definitely Jim in there, Ramona insists. I mean, he may use a voice distorter, but his diction and body language.
She looks around the table uncertainly.
You're serious, she says in a small voice.
Didn't he say he couldn't get a satellite signal inside the flying sub? Asks Mary.
We only have his word for it, I remind her. I look at the SE.
Are you serious? I ask. Do you really believe Jim wasn't inside that suit of armour?
I have heard no conclusive testimony to the effect that he was, says Dr. Armstrong. Merely conjecture based on diction and body language.
Oh, God. Officer Friendly was sitting behind me for the whole flight out, standing behind me. Whoever was in that suit could have leaned forward and garroted me and I wouldn't have stood a chance.
I do not believe you are in immediate danger, the SE says calmly.
We are merely investigating one low-probability contingency, echoes the mouse woman. That information received from a sister agency is of questionable accuracy.
Silver here leans back from the table and makes a steeple with his fingertips.
There are lessons to be learned,
he says. I can't help myself.
What lessons? I demand. Which agency? Are the police lying to us? Do you think Jim Gray is a plant?
He's not, begins Ramona. Chief Superintendent Gray is very definitely what he appears to be,
Dr. Armstrong interrupts.
The question is whether Officer Friendly is likewise.
But Officer Friendly is Jim Gray's superhero persona, I protest.
That's what Chief Superintendent Gray says,
agrees the mouse woman.
Certainly Chief Superintendent Gray wears Officer Friendly armour. Whether it is the only such suit of armour, however.
We think you should investigate further,
says the SE. He smiles.
What else?
Silver here clears his throat.
Your attestation ceremony as officers of the law was held in front of Woolwich magistrates yesterday morning and noted accordingly by the clerk of court. The paperwork is on its way to you. Try not to lose it. Ahem. An order in Privy Council will be issued tomorrow formally redesignating this organisation as the Transhuman Police Coordination Force. There is common law precedent and an amendment to the Serious Organised Crime and Police Act 2005 will be tabled in the next parliamentary session to regularise it. This leaves the IPCC inquiry. I believe we can head it off at the pass once you can demonstrate that you are acting lawfully to stop an imminent threat to your life.
Thank you for clarifying that, I say tiredly. So, the auditors have an on-site lawyer? What a surprise. What else should we be doing?
Generally, we want you to keep on doing what you're already doing, with perhaps a little more structure.
The SE folds his arms.
Continue to solicit interviews with suitably solid citizens and supervise their training and deployment. Collect forward intelligence on potentially disruptive superpower threats of 3 Sigma level and above. He pauses. You need to work out what story you're going to feed the public and media to explain where you came from, sooner rather than later. It'll need to be compatible with the global superpower origin cover we're developing, of course, but that shouldn't be too hard. He pauses again. And you might also want to investigate some sort of uniform or team costume.
Now wait a minute, says Mary,
a gravelly snarl creeping into her voice.
If you think you're going to get me to wear spangly fishnets...
Not at all, says the SE. But...
He gestures at my bagged-up suit.
Next time your clothes are ruined, you'll find it much easier to indent for a replacement if it's a uniform item, rather than personal office attire.
Are we done here?
Asks the mouse woman.
Not quite.
Dr. Armstrong spears us a long look.
I want you to know that I'm proud of you, despite being inadequately briefed, not to mention trained. You did far better than we could reasonably have expected today. But in future...
He momentarily looks as if he's sucking on a lemon.
Expect the worst. I'm afraid you won't be disappointed.